blue eyes with a touch of mascara. Hey! Marianne gave Frankie a quick cheek kiss and turned to Margot, taking her hand and pumping it like a shake weight. I'm so glad to meet you! Margot smiled, the sort of warm, genuine smile you could offer only when given such a greeting. But before she could answer, a tall brunette in a bright blue Dirty Deer t-shirt sidled up to the table with an order pad in her hand. Hey, girls. What can I get you? Hey there, Sierra. We'll take a round of iced teas to start and then get down to the serious drinking when you bring our food. Frankie jerked her thumb toward Margot. And this one needs to try some possum eggs before she dies. It's on the bucket list that she didn't even know she had. Will do, Sierra said, nodding. She glanced at Margot. Sweet or unsweet? Beg pardon? Did you want sweet tea or unsweetened? Sierra asked kindly. Oh, actually, I think I'll stick with water. Suit yourself. Sierra shrugged, then pointed at Marianne and Frankie, respectively. Half-sweet and insanely sweet, right? The MacReady girls nodded, pleased that the waitress remembered. Sierra shouted out a warning to a girl in her 20s who should have known better than to crawl on top of a pool table to make a difficult shot, and bustled across the room to stop her. What is the deal with sweet or unsweet? Margot asked. Why can't they just bring you unsweetened iced tea and let you add sweeteners yourself?
For proper southern sweet tea, you have to add the sugar to the brew while it's still hot. It lets the sugar dissolve evenly and you get a better tasting drink, Marianne told her. You can't do that at the table with a couple packets of Splenda.
Margot nodded.
All right. Can we talk about the fact that all women here, regardless of marital status, are called Miss? It means that you recognize that you're younger than the person you're talking to, or that you're not familiar enough to be on a completely first-name basis, Frankie said. It's a mark of respect. If you jump right to a first-name basis without permission, it's a sign you weren't raised right. Y'all don't do that up north?
No. And I am now sure I have offended 90% of the people I've met since I arrived in town, Margot said, pursing her lips.
So, Margot, Marianne said, it's nice to meet you
again, sort of. My mama says we were thick as thieves when we were little. I'm sorry, I don't remember anything from my time here.
Not your fault, Marianne said. Besides, we're here now, and it gives us a chance to talk away from the rest of the family. Because, well, we don't know a damn thing about you,
Frankie interjected. Marianne shushed her.
Frankie? What? You're the one relative we have that we know nothing about. And in our family, that feels like a pretty big hole. So we wanted to ask you a bunch of questions. But Marianne here was afraid you'd feel like you were in a job interview or something.
Sierra delivered the drinks, and Frankie picked up a menu and wordlessly pointed to a couple of items. Sierra nodded and sauntered away.
Actually, considering the fact that I'm trying to get job interviews, this could be good practice. So, basic stuff. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? What did you study? What kind of music do you favor? Are you a reader or a movie girl? Romantic history. Boring or completely sordid and nastier than I would expect of someone who dresses like a newscaster?
Frankie ticked the subject off on her fingers.
And most important, because this will determine whether we can truly be close friends or just cousins who tolerate each other, do you like mutant sea creature movies, yes or no? Not everyone has to like Sharktopus as much as you do, Frances.
Marianne groaned, rolling her eyes. Margot frowned. I dress like a newscaster?
A really classy one, Frankie assured her. Like the kind who would interview Michelle Obama on a morning show.
I'll get to your many, many, many questions in a minute, but I've just got to say, you seem really upbeat for someone who
works with corpses all day,
Frankie supplied. Margot pursed her carefully glossed lips. Trying to think of a nicer way to phrase it. Frankie snorted.
When I was around 8, I got really sick. Leukemia. A scary, rare form of it. I went through chemo, went bald by age 10. I had to go to St. Jude's for treatment and everything. I was lucky, though. Uncle Stan was able to donate bone marrow, and then Duffy a couple of years later. Uncle Stan would have done it again, but the first procedure was too hard on him. Really? Stan. Margot frowned. A bone marrow transplant for a sick kid? This did not match up with the wrung-out, selfish, drunk narrative. Frankie nodded, her purple highlights flashing in the harsh light. He was one of the first people to get tested. We were lucky I got matched up so easily. And now I've got triple the McCready running around in my veins, which makes me extra terrifying. It really does, Marianne deadpanned, subtly touching her temple and grimacing. Frankie didn't even look over at her cousin while she slapped her arm. She has all of the stubbornness of Uncle Stan and the creative stupidity of my brother, with none of the self-preservation instincts. Anyway, I spent a good part of my formative years staring my mortality in the face. And when I was 12 or so, I decided that I had to stop being scared of it because otherwise I was going to spend my life too scared to live it. So I went downstairs to the prep rooms and spent a lot of time with Uncle Junior, Duff and Marianne's daddy. He served as the undertaker before me. He taught me everything I know about taking proper care of the bodies, giving them dignity, making them look like themselves, so their loved ones have something to comfort them for the burial. Death spent too much time scaring me when I was a kid, so I'm gonna spend my adult years giving it the finger.
And the clothes and hair? Margot asked. Is that part of your finger strategy?
The clothes are chosen to mess with the locals, Marianne said.
Frankie opened her mouth to protest, but Marianne countered.
You have bookmarks in your internet browser marked clothing vendors to piss off the locals.
Frankie shrugged.
They call me Dr. Frankenstein. I might as well dress the part of the town weirdo. And as for the hair, after spending a couple of years without hair, I promised myself that I would never limit myself to one style or one color. If I want purple hair, damn it, I'm gonna have it.
Kids can be really mean, Margot said sympathetically.
Oh, it's not the kids. The adults are the ones calling her Dr. Frankenstein, Marianne said. Admit it. You enjoy provoking them. Fine, I'm provoking them, but they deserve it.
Do your parents ever feel bad naming you Frankie when, you know, you work with dead bodies?
Well, technically, I'm named Francis for my grandma on my mom's side. It was a happy accident.
Margot pursed her lips.
Was it?
Happy. Marianne snorted, and Frankie gave Margot's arm a friendly smack.
Triple the McCready stubbornness, hmm?
Margot laughed as Marianne rolled her big blue eyes. Conversation paused as Sierra delivered mason jars filled with an orange-red liquid on ice, the potato skins, and what appeared to be nachos covered in pulled pork.
What's this?
Margot asked as Frankie handed her a jar. She sniffed the drink, which smelled pleasantly of peaches and mint. She took a sip and puckered her mouth at the sharp bite of alcohol.
Well, it's still less dangerous than Leslie's coffee. This, darling cousin, is a Georgia peach. Locally made moonshine, peach schnapps, and a couple of other secret ingredients, Marianne said, as Margot took a longer pull on her jar.
The second sip went down much smoother than the first, and Margot smiled at the pleasant burn of liquor spreading to her belly.
You might want to take it slow. I know it tastes amazing, but moonshine will mess you up quick if you've never tangled with it before.
Oh, I'm sure I'll be fine as long as I eat something, Margot said, forking a possum egg onto her plate. She grimaced at the sheer amount of heavy carbs and pork in front of her, but gamely took a bite. It was delicious, which meant it was terrible for her. So, Marianne, tell me about yourself. Frankie says you have children?
I'm sure she politely described them as children and not hyperactive demon monkeys, Marianne said with a snort. Actually, for once I restrained myself, Frankie said. I didn't want to scare her. Well, you'll meet Nate and Aiden soon enough and decide for yourself. And my husband, Carl. He's been pretty busy lately. His tow-in traffic always spikes during the last weeks of tourist season. Too many people who have no business driving big vehicles over hills those vehicles weren't designed for in the first place. Carl and Marianne are disgustingly happy together, Frankie said. Honestly, you'd think after 20 years they'd run out of hormones or something.
20 years? Margot exclaimed over the rim of her jar. What, did you hook up when you were 12?
16. We're high school sweethearts. And remember, I'm a couple of years older than you, Marianne said, shrugging, with a happy little quirk to her full lips. Classic story of boy meets girl at a family barbecue, boy dates girl, girl runs away to a faraway college because she's afraid of being trapped in her tiny town. Girl graduates and finds job in big city, only to return to tiny town for the summer, and realize that she's actually miserable in the big city and missing the boy something awful. Girl abandons life in city to marry boy, gets immediately knocked up, and joins the PTA.
I keep telling you that's not a classic boy meets girl story, Frankie chided, sipping her own cocktail.
Margot grimaced. A family barbecue?
Oh, we aren't related, Marianne assured her.
He's a friend of Duffy's and got dragged along on the promise of free food. Carl's family didn't have much growing up, so a belly full of pulled pork was a strong attraction for a teenage boy.
And you don't work for the funeral home?
Marianne shook her head. I work for the law office here in town. It's better for me and my relationship with my mother.
There's only one law office in town?
Marianne's only a couple of credits away from being a lawyer, Frankie said. She does most of George Pritchett's work for him while he naps.
I'm a paralegal, and I really enjoy being a paralegal. I realized after working at a prestigious law firm and applying to law schools that I didn't really enjoy the long hours or the stress.
I will keep that in mind, Margot said.
There may be some legal action still pending from the flamingo incident.
Frankie raised her jar and pointed at her.
One day, we will get the full story from you, Margot. And on that day, the teasing will be legendary.
Margot nodded and clinked her jar against Frankie's. Her cousin grinned happily at her and inhaled nachos with gusto. Margot relaxed against the table. This was easier than she'd expected it to be, and certainly a lot more fun. She'd had girlfriends in the city she'd met for decompression drinks. But they hadn't returned her calls or emails before she left Chicago. And her dynamics with other young, upwardly mobile professional women had been biting and competitive. Every brunch felt like a poker game, a contest to see who would subtly drop word of their most recent triumph while keeping their disappointments close to the vest. Margot had come home from those outings feeling exhausted and uneasy rather than relaxed. How different might her life have been if she'd grown up close with Marianne and Frankie? Would she have been able to count on them for a sympathetic ear and easy camaraderie? Or would her mother have even allowed that? Linda had never valued social connections unless they paid off in some material way. Invitations to important events or exclusive clubs. Margot doubted very much that Linda would have let her run thick as thieves with her cousins. Her mother would have found some excuse as to why Margot didn't have time to spend with them, or assure her in private that her cousins really didn't like her in the first place. So, really, it might have been worse, knowing the relationship she could have had with them, but being kept from it by her mother's resentments. Singularly depressed, Margot finished off her jar and signaled Sierra for another.
Hey, there's Duffy, Marianne said.
Margot turned to see that her cousin had cleaned up for the occasion, wearing jeans and a freshly pressed blue dress shirt. He'd even made an attempt to slick back his curly hair. Margot was about to raise her arm to greet him, but Marianne caught her wrist and pressed it gently to the tabletop.
Hold on a minute, Frankie said softly.
Neither she nor Marianne peeling their eyes away from Duffy to look at Margot.
What is happening? Margot asked. watching as a short blonde with naturally narrowed green cat's eyes sauntered up to Duffy and hooked her fingers into his belt loops.
"Wait for it," Frankie whispered.
At first, Duffy didn't seem to want anything to do with the blonde, leaning away from her with the only frown Margot had ever seen on his face. The blonde tilted her head and walked her fingers up Duffy's chest while giving him this knowing grin that, frankly, made Margot's skin crawl.
"Wait for it," Marianne said.
Duffy rolled his eyes, and his face broke into a smile as the blonde dragged him out of the bar. Marianne groaned and pulled a 20 out of her pocket, handing it to a smirking Frankie.
"Again, I ask, what is happening?" "My brother does not learn," Marianne sighed. "It's human nature," Frankie told Margot. "That was Lana, Duffy's ex-wife.
They seemed..." Margot paused to search for a word that didn't translate to attached at the tongue. "Friendly."
"That's because Duffy, as much as I love him, forgets that Lana is a being of pure evil with a hell mouth between her thighs," Marianne grumbled, biting into a possum egg. "Every time she's been dumped and needs a self-esteem pick-me-up, Duffy lets her crawl into his bed."
"Is the hell mouth why he divorced her?" Margot asked, grinning at Sierra as she delivered a fresh mason jar. "Because that is illustrative."
"No, she divorced him, bless her heart," Marianne said.
"That didn't sound like you were wishing any form of happiness on your former sister-in-law," Margot said.
"I wasn't," Marianne said. "But I'm just southern enough and polite enough to say bless her heart instead of screw that knock-kneed bitch."
"The sweeter you bless somebody, the more you hate them. But nobody can get mad at you because you're just being a good Christian lady,"
Frankie said, her eyes wide and guileless. Margot shuddered. "I'm just glad women in Chicago didn't know about this."
"Anyway, Duffy held out hope that despite her sleeping with two of his friends concurrently, they could save the marriage," Frankie said, shrugging. "She was convinced that his best friend Paul Dabney was going to marry her and take her to that big old house in Southern Oaks. So she dumped Duffy right quick and let Paul know she was available. And because Paul is and always has been an insufferable jackass," Marianne interjected, "he decided Lana wasn't all that interesting when she wasn't married to Duffy. I'm only thankful that Duffy wised up enough not to let her back in the house."
"Sure, wise enough not to let her move back in. Wise enough not to prop her ego up with no strings attached rebound sex? Not so much," Frankie noted.
Marianne drawled,
"I live in hope."
Margot was drunk. She'd taken care most of her life to avoid this condition. Her mother's reminders of Stan's bad habits left little appeal to sloppy drunkenness. Plus, drinking equaled loose lips and poor judgment, and the kind of talk that could sink careers and social standing. She held a club soda as a prop at parties to keep her wits about her while her mother's circle schemed. And now, here she was, with unsteady feet and a head that felt floaty. She was sprawled against the edge of the table and laughing at stories that weren't really that funny, though at this point, she thought her cousins were downright delightful. She still felt together enough to try to straighten her posture every few minutes and appear sober, only to slump back against the table. Margot didn't know why she'd avoided it for so long, really. It was kind of awesome. She felt awesome. Her cousins were awesome. This bar was awesome. Lake Sackett was awesome. "Back in a minute," Margot said, carefully placing her wedge-clad feet on the concrete floor and putting one in front of the other in a manner that screamed, "Tragic first-time moonshine consumer."
"Don't break the seal," Frankie called after her. "It's science!"
Margot teetered down the barely lit corridor toward the bathroom doors marked Bucks and Does. She was glancing over her shoulder, waving at Frankie and hoping she remembered deer genders correctly, when she collided with a warm, solid object.
"Oh, I'm so sorry,"
she exclaimed, as two strong hands shot out to steady her on her wobbly legs.
You again?
Her head shot up at the source of the gruff voice, so quickly it made her dizzy. Sandy hair, thick dark blonde beard, big sad brown eyes. It was the troubled lumberjack. He wasn't wearing his serial killer utility coat, but he was right there in front of her, keeping her from falling off her shoes. Marco stared up at him. All the hurt in the world was contained in those eyes, and she wanted to hug him. She normally didn't go for beards with broken wings, but something in this man made her want to reach out and tell him that everything was going to be okay. No, wait. She was actually reaching out to him. Physically. With her hands. Not good. And he didn't seem very pleased about it either. He pulled back and frowned at her as she stretched her fingers toward his face. She rose up on her toes to press a feather-like kiss to his cheek. He froze, his hands contracting at her arms. "It's going to be okay," she whispered, kissing his cheek again. All the tension in his frame seemed to melt, curving his body around hers. She bobbed a bit, bracing herself against a nice solid chest. And her incorrigible hands were sliding down his t-shirt to a narrow waist. His hands contracted again, pulling her closer. She felt her cheek dragged against his whiskers as she pulled back, and then the softness of his lips brushing her jaw. Fireworks. Electricity. Heat blossoming from her belly and rolling heavy between her thighs. Every explosive and magical sensation she'd been promised by romance novels and Julia Roberts movies swelled inside her in one dizzying rush. He braced her elbows in his hands as he felt her drop, pulling his face toward hers. With a confidence born of already having hit rock bottom, she pressed her mouth against his. He froze up again, but this time he relaxed against her just a little faster, pulling her against him, moaning into her mouth, tentatively sliding his tongue across the seam of her lips. He didn't taste like booze, or even smoke. He tasted like Dr. Pepper. She fucking loved Dr. Pepper. Her errant fingertips slid up his side, stroking over corded muscle hidden by soft cotton, making him jerk and bark out a rusty-sounding laugh when she reached his ribs. She grinned against his mouth. Ticklish. She could work with that. His hand slid to the small of her back, securing her against him. She combed her fingers through his thick hair and found it softer than she expected. No product. Some people were just lucky. Except, he wasn't lucky. He was clearly hurting. At least, he had been until she came along with her lips and her wandering hands that seemed to make him somewhat happier. She was over-freaking joyed to have provoked that rusty, barking laugh. Sure, she was still sort of miserable about her current work-life-family chaos imbalance, but helping someone else escape for just a few moments? That was a heady thing. Her hands slid from his hair to his earlobes, rubbing lightly at the spot some ladies' magazine had described as a happy acupressure point. But for the haunted lumberjack, the earlobe seemed to be another ticklish spot because he huffed out another laugh into her mouth. He turned his head, the scratchy, soft texture of his beard tickling her palm, as he pressed a kiss to the center of her palm, which did nothing for the stability of her knees. He eased her arm around his neck and slanted his mouth across hers. His own hands, huge, by the way, enormous, splayed across her waist, his fingers resting just above the curve of her ass. His tongue lapped delicately against hers, as if he wasn't sure he had the right. And she welcomed him with firm, excited strokes of her own. Never breaking from her mouth, he urged her toward the emergency exit, a stumbling, awkward waltz out into the cooling Georgia night. Her shoes snagged on the gravel of the bar's parking lot, and he caught her, pinning her against him, and almost carrying her toward what she hoped was his truck. This was insane. Margot had never done anything like this before. Enthusiastic petting with a total stranger in a parking lot. She'd been too well supervised during her student years and too professionally paranoid as a young adult. She didn't do messy or complicated or awkward. But she knew if she stopped now, she would die. All the nerve and spine she'd managed to build in the last few days would be sapped out of her, and she would be a complete mess again. This was crazy. But so far, crazy had worked for her. He fumbled in his pocket and clicked the key fob to unlock his truck. He opened the passenger door and slid into the cab, pulling her with him. There was a second row of seats, and for a moment, Margot considered dragging him back there. Sure, there were things she couldn't do, considering her delicate condition. But she was a creative girl with a Cosmo subscription. She could improvise. He guided her into his lap. So she straddled his thighs and pressed his lips to hers, and the front seat felt just fine. Her hair fell in a gold curtain around their faces as she wrapped her arms around his neck.
"Are you sure you're okay with this?"
he asked, his breath puffing in cola-flavored whispers over her lips. She nodded, stroking her fingers along his throat, wringing her fingertips around the hollow. She spread those hands over his chest, caressing down his flat belly. Okay, she was just petting him now, to a ridiculous degree. Margot bit down gently on his bottom lip, and he groaned, rolling his hips up. It was warm and solid against her, rubbing with just enough insistence to make her legs weak. She'd done that to him, and she was sinfully proud of it. This was so much more than polite, no-strings frottage with a reasonably qualified partner sought out when she needed to scratch an itch. This was raw, throbbing need, and the heady fog of bad decisions. His fingers curved around her waist and almost met in the middle, guiding her down against him as he rolled up. She moaned, not remotely ashamed when her back instinctively arched and thrust her breasts in his face. He nuzzled his forehead against the smooth, warm skin above her neckline. Warm. She was so warm, and stupidly pleased with herself that absolutely everything seemed possible. He kept one hand at the small of her back, anchoring her to him while he reached down to recline the seat. She let loose a little squeak as they dropped back, sighing as her sensitive skin collided with his shirt. But his hot fingers at the base of her spine kept her from pulling away from him. "You have really big hands," she mumbled against his lips, as those long fingers cupped her ass through her dress. She moaned softly as he kneaded the flesh, moving up along her back, teasing the tension from her muscles.
"I do?"
She nodded, enjoying the way her lips brushed over his bristly upper lip. "You know what they say about men with big hands. They have big gloves." He laughed, the vibrations of that sound echoing through his chest to hers, and she moaned. And she'd made that happen. She grinned against his mouth, that wicked pride warming her through to her thighs. He skimmed those big hands up her arms to the straps of her dress, and then her phone buzzed in her purse. She tried to pull away from him, but his mouth followed her like a magnet. He grumbled softly as she leaned over and pulled her phone out.
"What?"
he panted against her neck. "I'm sorry," she whispered, dialing in her access code. Frankly, she was sort of amazed she was getting enough reception to receive a text. But there it was. A message from Marianne, blinking on her screen.
"Em, are you okay? Couldn't find you in the ladies' room."
Marianne. And Frankie. She just left them in the bar. She'd been gone for at least 15 minutes. Guilt splashed through her middle like rainwater from a bucket. She'd abandoned her cousins to make out with a strange man.
like some teenager at a kegger. She sat back and took in the kiss-drunk face of a stranger, pupils blown, an impressive erection tenting his jeans as he stared up at her, caressing her neck. Disgraceful! She shivered as her mother's disapproving voice echoed in her head. And mother was especially disapproving at the moment. Margot's stomach dropped. What the hell was she doing? She didn't even know this guy. She didn't know his name. What if he was some sort of psycho? What if he knew her family? What if he was her family? For all she knew, they were cousins. Oh my God, she whispered, climbing out of his lap.
What? Are you okay?
He sat up suddenly, his expression alarmed. I'm so sorry. She reached for the door handle, throwing her weight against the door.
Are you going to be sick?
No, I'm so sorry. Margot opened the truck door, suddenly very sober, and booked it across the gravel without looking back. The muggy Georgia air seemed to leave a clammy sheen on her skin, making her rub her hands over her upper arms. She walked into the front entrance of the Dirty Deer and found her cousins there talking to the manager with concerned expressions on their faces.
Honey, where were you?
Marianne cried, throwing her arms around Margot's neck. I just stepped out for some air. The liquor got to me a little quicker than I expected. But I think I'm ready to go. Don't you think we should go? Yeah, let's go. Now. Please? Frankie lifted a dark brow, skimming her eyes over hair Margot knew was disheveled and a dress that seemed to be sticking to her sweaty thighs. But much to Margot's eternal gratitude, her cousin said nothing.
That's okay. Just don't go wandering off again. Uncle Stan would kill us if we lost you, Marianne said.
Margot tried not to snort. Did I ruin the evening?
No, it's all right. Aunt Donna is our designated driver, and she's supposed to pick us up in a few minutes anyway. Be warned, when you're drunk, she thinks it's hilarious to speed up over the sharp drop so it feels like you're on a roller coaster.
Marianne nodded.
It's her way of making us pay the piper.
No chance of Uncle Bob picking us up?
No, my dad also wants us to pay the piper, Frankie snorted. He recognizes that I'm physically an adult, but still feels the need to parent me in a passive-aggressive fashion.
Well, that's kind of sweet, Margot said, glancing over her shoulder at the door, praying that her brooding lumberjack wouldn't storm through it and demand answers.
Do you say that because you haven't ridden with Aunt Donna yet?
Chapter 5 Margot sat slumped against the outside wall of her cabin, letting the heat absorbed into the porch soak through her suit jacket and soothe her aching everything. The price for this comfort was exposure to the evil sun, but she fought the unwelcome blast of light to her corneas with huge Jackie O sunglasses. She was just grateful that the possum eggs stayed down. She hadn't been this hungover, ever, and vowed she would never touch moonshine again as long as she lived. She was actually looking forward to a big mug of Aunt Leslie's chewy coffee. Despite her drunkenness, the physical exhaustion of white-knuckling through her Aunt Donna's driving, and the emotional exhaustion from fighting off post-truck makeout regret and mortification, she'd had trouble falling asleep. She'd tossed and turned in her narrow bed, kept awake by the sound of rocks being banged together. She'd gone to her window, searching her yard for drunken cousins or bearded locals who might think this was a funny prank, but she couldn't see anything but trees. She'd finally drifted off around 3 and woken up to a text from Frankie promising to pick her up for work. But instead of the tires over gravel crunch she expected, her ears were assaulted by the baying of Tootie's pack of hounds. Margot winced and slumped forward, clapping her hands over her ears.
Rough night, huh, honey?
Tootie called as the dogs clamored around her legs, sniffing and licking despite Margot's feeble attempts to bat them away.
I told Frankie to take it easy on you.
The first time you tangle with moonshine is like dancing with a good-looking carny. Sure, it feels great at first, but you wake up sore and soaked in regret.
Margot blanched.
Aunt Tootie shooed the dogs away and pressed a Tupperware container, the vintage turquoise brand, and a travel mug into her hands. She poked her head through Margot's unlocked cabin door.
Oh, it looks like you're getting comfortable. That little bird you hung up looks so nice. And the candles. I'm so glad you're settling in.
It's just a piece of window art. It's not like I'm signing a 5-year lease, Margot grumbled, opening the Tupperware. Inside, wrapped in wax paper, was a flaky golden biscuit the size of her fist, soaked in melted butter, with thick slabs of bacon, scrambled eggs, and melted Velveeta oozing out the sides. She quickly snapped the lid back on the container, breathing through her mouth to avoid the smell of food.
What the? Best cure for hangover is a big, greasy breakfast, Tootie told her. The bacon fights off the booze.
Is there any food available in this town that isn't soaked in pork fat?
Nope, Tootie said, shaking her snowy head. It's in the bylaws. If we're not feeding someone pork products, we get all twitchy and just start throwing biscuits at innocent bystanders.
Is it in the same bylaws that command you all to carry Tupperware with you at all times?
What do y'all carry your food with up north? Your bare hands?
A little beagle mix trotted up to Margot and balanced his chin on her knee. He whimpered and eyed her sandwich with his hopeful doggy eyes.
I will not share, she told him.
More whimpering. The big brown eyes seemed to get even bigger. Fine, she huffed, opening the container again and breaking off a little piece of biscuit. He snapped it from her fingers and gobbled it down. Margot sniffed at the travel mug and blanched. Was that oranges and garlic? Tootie hooted.
And that's my special secret cure.
What's in it?
You don't want to know, Tootie told her. Just down most of it in the first gulp or you'll lose your nerve.
Margot grimaced, but gamely pinched her nose shut and downed most of the mug in one long gulp. That's not so bad, she said, smacking her lips against the flavor of citrus. It tasted like a Flintstones vitamin with a chunk of habanero-flavored tuna for flavor.
Wait for it, Tootie said.
Margot recoiled at a combination of fish and fiery spice battling it out on her tongue.
There you go. Why are all the beverages here trying to kill me?
Margot spat, wiping her tongue with one of the many napkins Tootie had supplied with the biscuit.
Sorry. I'm usually more of a morning person. I didn't get much sleep last night.
Really? When I drink my own weight in moonshine, I usually conk right out.
No, I couldn't sleep because some animal was building a nest out of rocks or something right outside my window. I heard this weird clacking noise all night, which made sleep difficult even with the moonshine, she said.
Tootie waved her hand dismissively.
Oh, that's just the Sasquatch.
Margot laughed, but Tootie's expression remained completely serious.
Oh, come on. No, really. The Sasquatch have lived in these woods since before we even dreamed of climbing the mountains. They're harmless, really, as long as you stay out of their way. They just like to bang the rocks together to remind us that they're out there.
So, you're telling me that Sasquatch is loitering behind my house, clapping rocks together?
Tootie nodded.
That's why we told you to stay inside at night. Sasquatch don't appreciate it when you try to spy on them. There's a reason no one's ever seen one.
No one has ever seen one because they don't exist.
You tell that to the cryptid hunting teams that come through town trying to spot one. It's been the one area of tourism that's expanded for us over the last few years. We've been featured in 3 of those cable shows.
I would argue with you, but I'm just too damn weak.
Margo said. Donna's big red truck roared around the corner and skidded to a stop in front of Margo's cabin, riling up all the dogs. The barking alone was enough to make Margo want to knock herself unconscious with a moonshine jug. Donna, the roller coaster driver with the long, angular face and messy auburn curls, rolled down her passenger window and yelled, "How you doing there, big city?" over the loud purr of her engine. "I'm fine," Margo insisted, waving at her. Donna had hit every bump in the road between the bar and the MacReady compound the night before. She'd stopped short. Hell, at one point, she'd turned a corner so hard all three of her passengers' heads whacked together. "Just recovering from a driving-related concussion."
"I'll bet," Donna snorted. "Next time, don't wake me up to come get your drunk asses in the middle of the night and maybe I'll give you the kid glove treatment."
"Frankie said you told her to call you," Margo exclaimed.
"Doesn't mean I have to be nice about it,"
Donna called, gunning her engine and waving before speeding off. "She's just delightful," Margo muttered, peering into the Tupperware once more. Though the smell of bacon and cheese still made her stomach roll, she took a big bite and forced herself to chew. She groaned, letting the combination of comfort flavors coat her tongue. Her diet had been completely wrecked by her move to Georgia. She was going to have to rein in her carb consumption, or she wasn't going to be able to zip her pants. Still, it might be worth it.
"Don't mind Donna," Tootie told her. "She's been a little prickly since her husband died."
Margo thought Donna was more aggressive than prickly, but she figured that note wouldn't be well received. The beagle made a huffing noise and tried to nose at her container again. She rolled her eyes and broke off some of the bacon. He snapped it out of her fingers before she could even offer it, making her wipe her hands on another napkin. The dog put his paws on her legs, sniffing and attempting to lick at her hands.
"No! That's all you get. Don't be greedy. This doesn't make us friends."
The dog grumbled and put his chin back on her knee.
"I don't recognize him from the Great Closet Raid," Margo said, giving him an arch look.
"No, this here's a new addition," Tootie said, leaning down and scratching under the dog's chin.
"I'm calling him Arlo. Found him rolling around in the mud at the food carnival parking lot. But he cleaned up nice."
Margo thought Arlo's face, framed by the new blue collar Tootie had given him, was perfectly sweet. But she had no desire to form an attachment to a creature who could endanger her shoes. She loved her shoes.
"Go on," Margo told him.
"I've got to go to work, and I don't need to do that with dog hair all over my pants. So, shoo!" Arlo grumbled again, but Margo would not be moved.
"Shoo!"
Arlo huffed and sat back, but didn't move away.
"Oh, no, you gave Arlo food," Tootie said. "You're his buddy for life."
"Just what I always wanted," Margo muttered.
"Come on, hun. I told Frankie I'd drive you into work," Tootie said. "Eventually we'll get you your own car so you don't have to depend on us for transportation."
"I don't think that will be necessary," Margo said, opening the passenger door of Tootie's impeccably clean early model Cadillac. "I won't be here long enough to need my own car." Tootie made a little noise of disapproval before settling in behind the wheel and starting the engine.
"Y'all get going now," she called to the dogs. "Go on home."
Though the pack dispersed, Arlo remained on Margo's porch, his little dog chin resting on his forelegs. Margo would have to deal with that later. Tootie was oddly quiet on the drive to the funeral home. Margo wondered if she should stop referring to her eventual departure from Lake Sackett. She thought she was doing her family a favor, keeping them from having false hope that she would stay. She would have appreciated someone squashing her false hope when she was a child. But she could see that she was only upsetting Tootie. When Tootie turned the car into the MacReady's parking lot, a van labeled Bonnie's Blossoms was parked next to the building. and Margot watched as someone carried a huge princess phone composed entirely of bright pink carnations toward the back door. The phone was wound with a white sateen ribbon reading, "Jesus called her home," in magenta script.
"That'll be the floral centerpiece for Elsie Mayhew's visitation, bless her heart."
"I have so many questions," Margot marveled.
"Oh, yes. The heavenly connection is very popular among the older ladies,"
Tootie told her.
"The brighter the carnations, the better."
Margot shuddered. "I had an easier time believing in Sasquatch." She balled up her napkin. "Thanks for the disgusting curative smoothie and the pork products, Tootie. I feel almost ready to face my day."
"Oh, that's no problem, hun."
Tootie patted Margot's arm.
"Now, I don't judge someone tying it on every once in a while, and I'm glad you're getting to know your cousins, but it's best not to make a habit of this. That's not why you're down here."
The note of unease in Tootie's normally cheerful voice, underscored by the tiniest hint of judgment, made Margot's stomach turn. And between the hangover and the sunlight and the tang of oranges and tuna lingering at the back of her palate, the tight lid she normally kept on her emotions had loosened just enough.
"So are you going to give Marianne and Frankie the same hand pat and mini lecture, or is this just because I'm Stan's daughter?"
Tootie's eyes went wide.
"What do you mean by that?"
"I can assure you that I have never had a drinking problem. Last night was an anomaly. I joined in what I thought would be bonding activity with the cousins you want me to get to know so badly."
"I'm not saying that, Margot. I would never throw Stan's problem in your face like that. I'm just saying that spending time with your cousins is well and good, but going out drinking is not exactly how I hoped you'd spend your time with the family."
"I've barely had any time to spend with any of you," she said.
"Yes, that's what I'm saying," Tootie said. "I was hoping that when I moved you here, you would make more of an effort to get to know your daddy. But you've barely spoken to him."
"And I hoped that when you contacted me, it was to help me. But you seem to have some very definite ideas about why you did and didn't bring me down here." Before Tootie could reply, Margot climbed out of the car with more speed than she thought possible given the condition of her head. She slammed the car door behind her and instantly regretted it, not just for the noise, but also the insult to Tootie. Margot's position here was precarious. She knew that. And she'd just antagonized the matriarch of the family. If she wasn't careful, she would be booted out of her last resort before she'd had a chance to rebuild her life into something acceptable. She opened the funeral home's office door and was confronted by the walls lined with paint-by-number Jesus eye. This was not going to be a good day. Margot rolled her shoulders, dislodging the sleeveless silk shell where dried sweat had adhered it to her skin. Though she'd ruthlessly rehydrated herself with bottled water, she felt like the walking dead, which was an uncomfortable position considering her current location. Between Frankie's wincing at every sound and Margot's snippy mood, Uncle Bob figured neither of them was fit for public interaction. He kept Margot busy with paperwork in the office all morning. Today's Sisyphean task included learning the antiquated accepted style for newspaper obituaries. Apparently, people took it very seriously if their step-grandmother's cousin's second wife's uncle wasn't included in their loved one's death notice. But at least she hadn't been saddled with some of the more bitter, "ding-dong, the witch is dead" obituaries she'd come across in her research. People really enjoyed getting the last word in family arguments. Margot had proposed an alternative that morning, showing Bob the program that would allow her to establish an online memorial wall for the funeral home. But Bob had rejected her idea before she'd even finished showing him the features.
"People around here don't want their business put online, hon," he told her.
"But they're fine with airing all of their dirty laundry in the local rag?" Margot asked, lifting a copy of the ledger.
And as a follow-up question, do people in this town still read newspapers?
I know it doesn't make any sense, but it's just different,
Bob said.
There's a real distrust of technology around here. Hank Mason hooked his son's iPod into the church's PA system to play a hymn he found on the internet, and one of the seniors smashed the devil's rectangle with a shoe. It's your second day on the job, sweetie. Just slow down. Learn the ropes, and then you can make some changes. Why don't you just focus on learning to write the obits?
Bob gave her a pat on the head. What was with this family and head pats? And walked out of the office. Margot thought he was out of hearing range when she muttered, "It's not like it's that hard." But he was not. He heard. And that was when he put her in paperwork time out, leaving her in the office largely unsupervised. It gave her plenty of time to think about the lunch scheduled with her father and how that was going to play out. She had so many things she wanted to say to him, but she knew she wouldn't have time during one lunch, and she couldn't exactly fulfill her teenage fantasy of telling him off and throwing a napkin in his face. That would make staying in Lake Sackett too uncomfortable. She'd accepted that she probably wasn't going to get the answer she wanted that day. She was going to have to settle for collecting basic information about Stan McCready and hope that they could work up to her more complicated questions. At 10 till noon, Margot combed her hair and slicked on another coat of lip gloss. Stan wouldn't care about her grooming habits, she was sure, but it would settle her to know she looked her best. She waited, completing a few last-minute tasks that she could walk away from easily. She ignored the condor-sized butterflies in her belly. It surprised her how unprepared she felt for this type of relationship. She thought she'd been close with her mother and stepfather, but she realized, watching the casual affection the McCreadys showed one another, that her family had been guarded, even in their relaxed moments. Margot was reserved with Bob, uncomfortable with the encouragement he offered her at almost every turn. And she was even more politely distant with Tootie, who was a lot to handle even without a hangover. What if she wasn't capable of being a daughter to a father? What if she found that Stan was a horrible person? Or Stan decided he didn't like her after all? No, this was just lunch, she told herself. She had nothing to lose. This would not change her life. She was fine either way. So why did the 2 minutes after 11:58 seem to take so damn long? Margot's foot jiggled under her desk in time with the fingers tapping against the surface. The digits finally crept to noon and... nothing. He was late, that was all. Just running a little late. Margot was sure he was going to be there any minute with an explanation involving work, and in the spirit of cooperation, she would graciously shrug it off. As the minutes ticked by, her inclination to be generous eroded like Cousin Duffy's truck bumper. Margot stood, slipped on her jacket, and walked a lap through the funeral home. She offered a polite but muted smile to the Aikmans, who were discussing their mother's service with EJJ. Stan was nowhere to be found. Returning to her office, just in case Stan showed up after all, Margot pulled out her phone and texted Frankie down on the morgue level. "Have you seen Stan?" Frankie replied.
"You're texting me from one floor away? Just come downstairs."
"That's not happening."
"Fraidy cat."
"Okay, but have you seen my..." Margot stopped typing and backspaced to replace my with, "Stan?"
"Nope. Haven't seen him for about an hour."
"Did he have to go pick up a body?" Margot asked.
"Nope. My dad took pickups this afternoon because of your lunch plans."
Margot breathed deeply and counted to 10. Stan didn't have a work-related excuse for being late. She rubbed a hand over her sternum, willing the acidic burn there to fade away. She would not get upset over this. She would stay calm. She would be fine.
A memory bubbled to the surface of her mind. Of a very small Margot waiting at the window of their first little apartment in Chicago, watching the street. She just knew her daddy would be coming down the street at any minute. His big green truck would make that roaring noise, like a tiger, and she would know he was getting close, just like back home. She didn't care what Mama said. This little room on the second floor of the moldy-smelling building wasn't home. Home was the lake, and Tootie's house, and the dogs. Daddy would be here any minute to take her home. She knew it. Margot shook her head. No. That memory couldn't have been real. She'd spent years in therapy, and never come close to any recollection like that. That was just a weirdly real daydream, brought on by a few emotionally intense days and the remnants of moonshine in her brain. She was fine. This was disappointing, but hardly surprising. Stan had spent her whole life avoiding contact with her. Why would he suddenly want to schedule a one-on-one meeting just because Aunt Tootie had wedged Margot into the family's life again? Margot had set herself up for this. Now, she knew better than to reach out to Stan again. Lesson learned. Her head rose when she heard a light knock at the office door. She refused to let her disappointment show when she saw that it was Frankie.
It's 12:19, Frankie said, her red mouth turning down at the corners. That's why you were texting, right? Uncle Stan didn't show up?
No, he did not. Margot opened a new file on the computer and started another obituary.
Damn it, Stan!
Frankie grumbled, whipping out her phone with its Avengers-themed cover.
I texted him, but he hasn't responded, the doofus. I can't believe he did this.
It's nothing, really. Margot smiled, even though it made her face ache.
It is something,
Frankie insisted, her cheeks red and flushed.
I've told him, well, never mind what I've told him, but I told him what would happen if he pulled something like this.
You two talked about me? Margot asked.
He was nervous about today, Frankie said. He needed a pep talk.
Margot pinched her lips together and didn't respond. Frankie tapped out messages on her phone while Margot typed out the names of Mrs. Aikman's grandchildren.
He's still not responding, even though my text messages are showing up as red.
Frankie seethed, shoving her phone in her pocket.
Do you want his cell number? Maybe he'll answer if he knows it's from you.
No. If he wanted to be here, he would be here. I'm not going to beg him.
There has to be a good reason for him not being here, Frankie protested.
Then he can answer for himself. Frankie, I appreciate how concerned you are, really, I do, but you can't do the work for Stan in this situation. Let this go.
Well, at least go get something to eat. Just because Uncle Stan is being a jackass doesn't mean you have to starve.
I have a protein bar in my purse for days like this. I'll be fine.
That is the saddest damn thing I've ever heard, Frankie said. A bar is not a meal, sweetie.
I'm fine.
So you keep saying,
Frankie said.
If you need anything, let me know.
I will. Thank you. Margot dropped her head, breathing deeply as Frankie's sneakers thunked down the hall. Nothing had changed since this morning. Her father was still unreliable and unavailable. She'd lost nothing. Nothing about her life had changed. And when she went to the bathroom to check her makeup, she told herself it was the humidity that had smeared her mascara. Hours later, Uncle Bob stuck his head in the office door to find Margot still at the desk, updating pre-planned service files. His expression was uncertain, as if he expected her to snap at him after that morning's irritability.
Hey, Margot. I just got a call from Mary Ann. She's stuck over at the elementary school. She took the boys there for back-to-school night, and her car's dead. Something about an angry check engine light. I would go, but I have about 30 pounds of King Ranch potatoes arriving any minute for Miss Elsie's visitation dinner. Do you mind wrapping up and taking the van over there to pick them up? Carl can go get the car later.
Sure, no problem, she said, not bothering to ask what King Ranch potatoes were, because the answer would